Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wayne Smith, former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana under the Carter administration, who talks about the former president's historic visit to Cuba and recent accusations leveled at Fidel Castro by the Bush White House. Wayne Mattson, former National Security Agency officer, who charges that the U.S. military played a direct role in the April 11th Venezuelan coup, which failed to oust the government of President Hugo Chavez. And Debbie Elkin of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace, who talks about her five-day, 70-mile walk to end occupation from New Haven to New York City. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Nation magazine reports that an old, deadly, infectious disease, tuberculosis, is making a comeback. Across the globe, now one of every three people has some form of this killer disease, usually in the developing world. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is revving up its war on bioterrorism. In the new budget, the White House wants to spend $6 billion to fight bioterror agents like anthrax, but only proposed to spend $200 million to fight the known killers of AIDS, TB, and malaria. In strictly cost terms, that equals $1 billion for each anthrax victim last year, but only $33 for each victim of the more common illnesses of tuberculosis and malaria. Last year, over 3 million people died from AIDS across the world, with 40 million more people infected with HIV. Africa alone accounts for 20 million HIV and AIDS cases. Currently, 2 billion people are infected with latent tuberculosis, which with adequate medication can be treated at a 90% success rate. But on Capitol Hill, conservatives in Congress are pushing to cut global health programs from the budget of the Centers for Disease Control. Last fall, anti-abortion Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey and several other conservatives blasted the CDC for what they characterized as inappropriate actions, such as funding outreach programs to gay men. They wanted the money to fight bioterrorism. The Bush administration caved into the pressure from these social conservatives and cut $340 million from the CDC's non-terrorism budget. Sri Lanka native Manikava Sagam Suresh is snarled in Canada's criminal justice system. He has been in and out of jail for 6 years, having been charged with fundraising for the separatist rebel movement, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, which is engaged in an 18-year war with the government of Sri Lanka. In early April, the rebel group announced it would renew peace talks. Suresh was detained in 1995 and ordered deported from Canada, but in 1998 he was released under strict supervision. In January, the Canadian Supreme Court ordered a full review of the case, including the secret evidence that the government has collected against Suresh, evidence that has never been shared with Suresh's defense lawyers. Both the Canadian and the American governments have labeled the Liberation Tigers a terrorist organization. Barbara Jackman, Suresh's attorney, told the World Press Review magazine that the Canadian prosecutors have not made the distinction between political expression and aiding a terrorist organization. In the early 1990s, Suresh worked for a Tamil-based community center that had ties to the rebel group. Prosecutors counter that Suresh knew that the funds he was raising would go to buy weapons that would be used to kill civilians. Francis Xavier, head of the Canadian Council of Tamils, says the government should reconsider the case because Suresh would likely be tortured if forced to return to Sri Lanka. Tiffany is known all over the world for its expensive jewelry, watches, and crystal. But, according to the Fairfield County Weekly, the high-end retailer has a dirty little secret that it keeps from its wealthy customers. Tiffany & Company relies on jewelry contractors that exploit Latino immigrant labor. Riva Jewelry Manufacturing, based in Sunnyside, Queens, is one Tiffany contractor that always keeps its factory windows shut tight, even though its 145 workers routinely use toxic chemicals. The company, which sells 75% of its wares to Tiffany, also scans its workers with metal detectors 5 times a day. 18 months ago, Riva workers contacted Unite, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Workers. 120 workers signed union cards, but Riva management fought back with an intense anti-union campaign and beat Unite in a federally supervised election. the union appealed to the National Labor Relations Board, which nullified the election and documented 135 unfair labor violations. Now Unite is campaigning to pressure Riva to recognize the union and negotiate a contract. On May 9th, Unite turned up the heat on Tiffany by organizing pickets at 25 stores in the U.S. The aim of the pickets was to inform the company's wealthy customers about the harsh working conditions at Riva, where workers earn only $7 an hour to make jewelry costing thousands. So far, Tiffany has denied responsibility for the working conditions at Riva and says Unite's pressure tactics will only lead to Riva workers losing their jobs. Unite organizer Megan Chambers calls Tiffany's position outrageous. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Not since the Cuban Revolution in 1959 has a sitting or former U.S. president visited the island of Cuba. However, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, on a personal invitation by Cuban President Fidel Castro, has made a five-day visit to the island nation. As part of his stay, Carter held several meetings with Castro, dissidents, and addressed the Cuban people across the island in Spanish that was broadcast live on both TV and radio. The former American president focused on the history of U.S.-Cuba relations, human rights, and the efforts to normalize relations between the two governments. Days prior to Carter's visit, the Bush administration launched an anti-Cuba campaign on May 6th, when Undersecretary of State John Bolton made a number of unsubstantiated allegations accusing Cuba of developing and maintaining a sophisticated offensive biological weapons industry and of providing information about them to enemy governments. Wayne Smith is a former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana under the Carter administration and is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about Carter's historic visit to Cuba and the Bush administration's hardline policy toward Castro.
Carter is going as a private citizen. He has no diplomatic tools with which to negotiate, so we can't expect miracles to come from this visit. Nonetheless, the fact is, more was accomplished during the Carter opening to Cuba than any time before or after. Thousands of political prisoners were released. The Cubans began to allow Cuban Americans to return to visit their families. Now about 125,000 a year go. That started under Carter. He opened communications. Carter believes in dialogue. He's also intensely interested in human rights, democracy, freedom of expression, and he will raise all those issues. And he has already talked to dissidents and human rights activists in Cuba, which is very good because it gives them new legitimacy and their causes new legitimacy.
3 days prior to his leaving on May 6th, the Undersecretary of State John Bolton charged Cuba with producing weapons of mass destruction and supplying that information to rogue states. There has subsequently been a comment by former President Carter and a kind of a back-off response by Colin Powell saying that we never really accused them but said that the technology was there. However, the media picked up on that and ran with it, and that's basically all you heard for just about 3 days. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that statement by Undersecretary of State Bolton was most unfortunate. Cuba has a highly developed biotechnology industry. It produces medicines and vaccines, some vaccines that we don't even produce, such as for meningitis B, and it sells those on a worldwide basis. Any biotech industry that sophisticated could possibly have the capability of producing bacteriological or biological weapons. But there is no evidence whatever that Cuba has done so or that Cuba has any intention of doing so. Mr. Bolton's statement statement suggested that Cuba has the technology and is selling it to other rogue states, which is simply not true. He also said that President Castro continues to put forward terrorism as a form of, as a political weapon, which he does not. Castro has denounced terrorism in no uncertain terms. So it was a most unfortunate and inaccurate statement, one without a shred of evidence, and one suspects that perhaps it was made just before the Carter visit in order to muddy the waters. In other words, to put the visit in an unhappy context. And also it was made without any question because the elections are coming up in Florida in November, and the hardline Cuban exiles have been complaining that the administration has not taken seriously enough their allegations concerning this biological warfare capability in Cuba. So now the administration has caved to them, is going to put forward this as a threat.
What about the fact that the United States maintains Cuba on its list of terrorist states?
It's absolutely absurd. They put forward three reasons for doing so. Number one, they say because there are Basque terrorists being harbored in Cuba. There are some Basque living there. They came first under an agreement with the Felipe González government of Spain some years ago. The Felipe González government had asked the Cubans to take them. They also say, State Department also says, that Cuba's harboring American fugitives. Yes, there are some American fugitives there. No evidence that any of them were involved in terrorist activities. But by the same token, there are Cuban fugitives in the United States, and some who have been involved in terrorist activities, according to FBI files. And yet, there they are, being harbored in Miami.
President Bush is supposed to make an address on May 20th, I believe, on the policy on Cuba.
Yes.
And what do you think he's going to
do? Well, he will announce a new hard line, the hardening of travel controls and so forth.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what do you think it's going to take to normalize relations between the U.S. and Cuba? It's been 43 years, basically. This is the first former or sitting president that has ever visited Cuba.
No, I think that it is going to take Bush being out of office, or at least in the second term. Look, the momentum is in that direction. Polls all indicate that the American people understand that the embargo is obsolete, counterproductive. Farmers want to sell their products. Businesses want to do business. Congress is already moving in the direction of removing some of the sanctions. It will come. The Bush administration at this point stands in the way, but who knows, maybe after 2004, even it will decide to move aside.
That was Wayne Smith, former chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana under the Carter administration and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. After a coalition of conservative businessmen, labor groups, and sectors of the armed forces failed to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, speculation has grown that the Bush administration may have played an important role in the failed April 11th coup attempt. Former National Security Agency officer Wayne Mattson charges that under the cover of training exercises in the Caribbean during the coup, the U.S. Navy monitored and jammed communications in Caracas with particular focus on the Cuban, Libyan, Iranian, and Iraqi diplomatic missions. He also says that the Military Psychological Warfare Operations, or PSYOPs, unit produced television and radio announcements broadcast as part of the coup operation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wayne Mattson, who now serves as the Washington correspondent for Intelligence Online based in Paris. Here he summarizes the logistical support, which he maintains was provided by the Bush administration to the coup plotters.
It looks like it's the old infrastructure that dates back to the time of the Iran-Contra scandal. We have our various CIA proprietaries that were involved. Of course, many of those were involved in the original Reagan, Bush, the first scandal involving Iran-Contra. Many of those people were brought back into play, specifically the George Bush, the first administration, and the Reagan administration that were involved in this coup.
Now, maybe you could run down some of the operations that the U.S. Navy, the CIA, and other elements of the Pentagon What exactly were they doing in assisting the coup plotters?
Well, first and foremost, there was a major U.S. Navy exercise taking place in what's known as the Southern Puerto Rico Operations Area, which extends from Vieques, where there's been an awful lot of controversy concerning U.S. bombing of the island off of Puerto Rico. But that operational area extends all the way to the Venezuelan coast. Some of the ships involved in this exercise were, from what my sources told me within the Pentagon, involved directly with the coup. And I noted that even President Chavez said that the military within Venezuela is now looking at the presence of one naval vessel and a couple of aircraft off of the coast of Venezuela during the time of the coup that they maintain were possibly American ships and aircraft. During the coup, I was told that all communications within Caracas were being jammed from various sources. I was told that some of the jamming was the responsibility of U.S. military units stationed on naval ships off of the coast of Venezuela. But also, you know, we also have a large counter-narcotics presence in neighboring countries on islands off the coast of Venezuela, and that includes Aruba, Curacao, and units within Colombia, which were not so much involved in counter-narcotics as they were during the coup with support for the coup plotters, and that would have entailed jamming of signals, which I understand from people in Caracas extended to even the jamming of taxi radio frequencies. Also, what I was told is the frequencies that were used by the Cuban, Libyan, Iraqi, and Iranian diplomatic missions in Caracas were also being not only monitored, but also jammed.
There's more information wanted to detail here, Wayne Madsen, but maybe sort of intermediately here you can tell our listeners how you came by this information and if it can be substantiated, do you think?
Yes, well, I first heard from Pentagon sources last June that a U.S. Army Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel, whose name subsequently appeared on the wire services, somebody named Lieutenant Colonel James Rogers, was sent to Caracas with the sole intention of making contact with labor unions, people within the oil industry, friendly military officers, to foment a coup against President Chavez. So it didn't come as any great surprise to me when I first heard that this coup was taking place. It just so happened, though, that I was at a military get-together here in Washington, one of these formal affairs, when the night the coup actually took place. So I was able to actually talk to people who were somewhat in on the planning and some of the military operations that were going on that had to do with the coup itself.
So, well, not to compromise your sources, but basically you got this information directly from the horse's mouth, active duty intelligence folks, is that right?
Active duty intelligence folks, also retirees who are still working within the military in the capacity of consultants. The fact that the United States is now saying that it played no role in the coup is sort of like the scene from Casablanca where the French inspector walks into Rick's Cafe and says he's shocked to find gambling going on in the establishment.
What can you tell us about the military's psychological operations unit and what they did by way of producing television announcements in Spanish for use during the coup?
Absolutely. This is one of the major tasks of the PSYOPs unit. And interestingly enough, the unit within the Army that is in charge of PSYOPs is based at Fort Bragg, the same unit from which the number one coup plotter, this Lieutenant Colonel Rogers, came from. So, yes, there were broadcasts on Venezuelan television during the coup that insinuated that it was Chavez's people that shot at the demonstrators who were converging on Miraflores Palace. So it looked like a classic disinformation campaign, and of course this is what U.S. Army PSYOPs people specialize in. I mean, it's typical of the State Department to deny any involvement in these matters. I mean, we can go back to the coup against Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. We had all the same makings then as we had with the Venezuela coup. U.S. Navy ships off the coast that were helping out the coup plotters. We had a massive amount of denials from the U.S. Embassy saying they were not involved with it. But we know from various documents that have been released under the Freedom of Information Act that, of course, the Navy was involved in that coup. Of course, the CIA was involved with that coup. And, of course, Henry Kissinger was pretty much the person that ordered it. So it looks to me like the people that are in power now in the Bush 2 administration are playing from the same playbook that was used back in the 1970s in the Nixon administration.
That was Wayne Mattson, former National Security Agency officer and Washington correspondent for the Paris-based Intelligence Online. Read Mattson's articles about the Venezuela coup online at www.counterpunch.com. The news that Israel's ruling conservative Likud party voted on May 12th to reject the creation of a Palestinian state over the objections of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was seen as another major obstacle to restarting Middle East peace negotiations and a slap in the face of President Bush, who has explicitly supported the establishment of such a state. Although the vote by Likud's small central committee was part of the domestic political struggle between Sharon and his rival Benjamin Netanyahu, the vote is likely to fuel support for militant Palestinian groups who advocate continued armed struggle. While escalating Middle East violence has dampened hope for peace, groups here in the U.S. and around the world are engaging in new and creative actions advocating a just settlement to the conflict. In early April, a Jewish woman living in Connecticut, horrified by the war Israel was waging in the Palestinian territories, helped organize a group of activists who walked from New Haven to New York City in a personal appeal for peace with justice in the region. Debbie Elkin and half a dozen others, mostly Jews, began their walk at the Holocaust Memorial in New Haven by saying Kaddish, a Jewish prayer for the dead, and singing a peace song in Hebrew. Over 5 days, they walked the 77 miles to Manhattan, ending with visits to the United Nations and the Israeli consulate. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Elkin about her experiences on the walk to end occupation, how her group was received in New York, and the actions she and others hope to take in support of a just settlement of the decades-old Middle East conflict.
It was amazing to meet all the people we met along the way. Everyone was amazed to see us and to hear that we were walking from New Haven to New York City. And we got into different little discussions along the way, but it was just, there were so many different reactions, but people were so stunned, and it seemed to really touch a chord in their hearts that we were doing this for something that everybody is upset about and longing for peace.
When you got to New York, you went to the Israeli consulate and to the UN, right? And what happened there?
They were not very interested in talking to us. They were very interested in us being outside of where they were. And at the UN, they sent down someone to listen to our letter and take the letter. At the Israeli consulate, after waiting for a little while in the lobby, they told us no one was available to come down. I just went ahead and read the letter anyway to the person who was there, and the security person and the person at the desk. And a policeman sort of ushered the other folks out.
And what was the content of the letters that you wanted to deliver?
We were saying that for the sake of Jews as well as Palestinians, Israel's war against the Palestinians and Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem should end, and that the United States should stop its funding of the occupation and of the war against Palestinians. And with the UN, that the UN should intervene to stop the violence. I think the thing that we were saying that was different from what many other people were saying was that we were saying this is good for Jews as well as for Palestinians, this position of ending the occupation. And someone passed us and said, "Are you for the Palestinians?" We said, "We're for both the Jews and the Palestinians." That seemed to be a consistent surprise to people, that we see our position as best for everybody.
Now that you've finished, what are your next steps?
Trying to be a voice in support of all of the Israeli peace movement and of the soldiers and officers who've refused to serve in the occupied territories. As of today, there's 436 of them, 36 of whom are in military prison. So we're helping to be a voice here to say stop U.S. support of the Israeli occupation for the sake of Jews as well as for Palestinians. This, for anybody that wants to support Jews and Israel, this is the best position to take. There are a number of ideas that people have had. One idea is to have smaller walks, but walks all across the country to our congressional offices.
I know you've been meeting with representatives of mainstream Jewish organizations, bringing your point of view to those conversations, but what has come out of that, or where do you think that's going to be heading, or do you have any thoughts about the best way to work with other Jews, either as individuals or as, you know, within Jewish organizations in the U.S.?
I think it's important to build the bridges, to agree where we can agree, to acknowledge the fear that this brings up for Jews, even though it's the Palestinians that are getting the brunt of Israel's actions. Jews are also being bombed, and then it's bringing up the fear of being wiped out. And to say over and over, when we're trying to reach out to Jews, that we are for the safety of Jews, we are for the safety of Israel, that ending the occupation and creating a Palestinian state, an independent Palestinian state, living in peace with Israel, is the best way forward for the safety of all people. And I think a lot more listening needs to go on all sides.
That was Debbie Elkin, a founding member of a new group, the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace, which can be contacted by calling area code 510-848-8796 or visit their website at www.brittzedek.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.